Welcome to this Forthright Radio for October 5th, 2019. I'm Joy LaClaire. With us for the full show is Tom Hartman, progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host. He's a New York Times best-selling, four times Project Censored award-winning author of over 24 books in print in 17 languages on five continents. Among his many books are Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became, quote, People, end quote, and How You Can Fight Back. Leonardo DiCaprio was inspired by Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, to make the movie The 11th Hour, in which he appears. His latest books are in his Hidden History series, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, and The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, both published by Barrett Kohler Publishers. We began our interview considering what the founders discussed in creating a federal system of government with three branches, a legislative with two chambers, the House of Representatives and the Senate, the executive, and the Supreme Court. Did the framers of the Constitution propose that the Supreme Court or any single branch have power over the others? Specifically, did they want the Supreme Court to be able to negate the workings of the other two branches?
There were some who felt that the Supreme Court should have that power, but I'd say probably most of the framers of the Constitution and that founding generation were very wary of that much power being concentrated in any one branch of government. And if there was to be a superlative power, if any one branch of government or part of a branch of government was to have an extraordinary amount of power, it should be the House of Representatives above all else, which is largely what they did. You know, they gave the House the power of all appropriations have to start in the House, all tax has to start in the House, all declarations of war have to start in the House, and those are things that are foundational powers. Hamilton lays this out in a series of three or four Federalist Papers that argue or lay out basically what the Supreme Court is going to be. And in some of them, Hamilton comes right out and says, you know, there won't be any power of judicial review. The Supreme Court won't be able to strike down laws. He doesn't say it quite like that, but it's fairly clear what he's saying, that the court is the least likely to offend. They do not have the power of the purse, which is the Article I branch of Congress. They don't have the power of the sword, which is the Article II branch, the executive branch, the president, who is commander-in-chief of the military. And so they're the most innocuous of all of the three branches. Originally, the Supreme Court was conceived of as, and the reason why we had a need for a Supreme Court, was to be the final court for resolving issues and debates and things like that. You know, there has to be a place where the buck stops. If two people are engaged in a lawsuit and one person A wins in one court, then they can appeal it to a higher court, and person B might win there, and then person A appeals that to a higher court, and it can go back and forth and back and forth. There has to be a place where the buck stops. And so the Supreme Court, Article 3 of the Constitution, lays out that the Supreme Court basically has what's called original jurisdiction. In other words, it's the court you start with in cases between, in disputes between the states, and in cases that involve international issues, disputes between the United States and other governments, things like that, and maritime law. But when it comes to being the court of final appeals, that is the province of the Supreme Court, but only under exceptions and regulations defined by Congress. So Article 3, Section 2 is quite clear that Congress can actually say, we're passing this law and you may not rule on it, Mr. or Mrs. Supreme Court or whatever. And they can also regulate the Supreme Court. They can determine how often they meet, how many cases they take, although they've never actually determined those kinds of things. But they can fully regulate the court. They certainly regulate the size of the court, and that's been all over the place over the years. So that changed in 1803 in a case. So that was all kind of ambiguous at the signing, the ratification of the Constitutional Convention in 1789. And in 1803, in the third year of Jefferson's presidency, in a case called Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court just took this power onto themselves. And Thomas Jefferson's arch political enemy, John Marshall, and third cousin, who was the Chief Justice of the court, John Adams, put him on the day before he left office as a dig to Jefferson. At that point, Jefferson and Adams hated each other. And this was the greatest insult that Adams could do, which was to appoint Jefferson's cousin to the Supreme Court, which he did. And in 1803, Marshall ruled in this Marbury versus Madison case against the Secretary of State, James Madison, that the court could strike down the Judiciary Act of 1797, which modified how the courts worked. And Jefferson went nuts. He wrote a letter to Abigail Adams. He wrote to Spencer Roane. He wrote to George Mason. I mean, he was just all over the place. He was president at the time. And he said, if this decision stands, then the Constitution has become a thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary. Under this understanding, the Constitution has become a felo de se, which is Latin for a suicide pact. He said, this decision will make the court the most despotic branch, arguing basically that if the court had this power of judicial review, that they would become the kings and queens of America, unaccountable to the people. So that's kind of the nutshell history of judicial review and where it came from. And the blowback, by the way, Jefferson was not the only one who was outraged. I mean, there was a broad outrage that just swept the country, particularly among the political class, when Marbury was decided. And it so burned John Marshall's fingers that he never again, in any consequential way, used judicial review, used a constitutional argument. And in fact, no Supreme Court did in 1856. Roger Tawney, who was Chief Justice at that time, and he decided that he was going to once and for all solve the problem of slavery. And that was the Dred Scott decision, which led us right into the Civil War. Now it's pretty much all the court does.
Yeah, I was just going to say, those words sound very prophetic with our situation today, where laws can be passed by large majorities of Congress, signed by the president, and then tossed out by 5-4 vote of the Supreme Court. In some ways, it feels like a constitutional crisis to many people, and I kind of count myself among them. You do a wonderful job, Tom Hartman, in your book, The Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, documenting the history of different decisions. But I want to get to a more modern era, and perhaps we'll have time to go back to some of the history, a pivotal period where the soon-to-be Justice Powell, who was a corporate attorney at the time, issued what has become known as the Powell Memo. Tell our listeners about that.
Lewis Powell was a lawyer. His largest client was the tobacco industry. He lived in Richmond, Virginia. In 71, he was a conservative activist. And in 71, he was just freaked out. Rachel Carson was published in 62. The publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson in 65 was the year that Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed had been published. And these two books literally caused legislation to happen. They created this consumer movement and the environmental movement. The pressure was building to create the Environmental Protection Agency and to hold car manufacturers accountable for the safety of their products. And Powell saw this as essentially the ascendancy of communism. And so he wrote this memo to his next door neighbor and close friend, Eugene Sindor, who was the head guy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce at the time. And the memo essentially said, we being wealthy people and businesses in America, we have been reluctant to engage in politics. And that was true, by the way, in 71. Companies did very little lobbying. In fact, in 1980, there was only $200 million worth of lobbying in D.C. Now it's like $6 billion a year. He said, you know, we've been very reluctant to engage in politics. We haven't supported political candidates. But Ralph Nader and Rachel Carson, he named them in his memo, are leading movements that are going to be destructive to the free enterprise system. And if we want to save the system and survive as a nation, we need to rise up and take back our colleges, take back our public schools, take our courts and stack the courts, take over the media. We need to be buying media. We need to build think tanks to mold public opinion. We need to buy publishing companies, radio and TV stations. the whole spectrum of American life, he was saying, basically has to come under the control of conservative forces. Otherwise, we're going to slide down the road into communism. And this was around the same time that, in fact, it was just after. It was just a few years after Ronald Reagan recorded his famous recording in, I guess that was 66 or 67, where he said that Medicare was going to be the beginning of socialism in the United States. And if Medicare came into law, someday we will all look back and remember the time when men were free. This thinking was not unique to Powell. It was widespread in Republican circles. And so what it did was Sindor circulated that among these big corporations at the Chamber of Commerce, and it made its way to a number of very, very wealthy people, most notably Joseph Coors of the Coors Brewing fortune and the heirs to a number of other companies, Richard Mellon Scaife and his friends. They tossed in millions and millions of dollars and created the Heritage Foundation, the Koch brothers helped the Charles Koch Foundation, reinvented itself as the Cato Institute. He said we had to take over our courts. The Federalist Society was founded, all as a result of the Powell Memo. He literally rewrote the history and fate and future of America. And within 9 years, with the election in 1980 of Ronald Reagan, by 81, we had flipped from a classic economic model, the Adam Smith economic model, into a neoliberal economic model, the Chicago School libertarian experiment of deregulation and lower taxes. And of course, it has, now we can look back on this and say, for 40 years, the neoliberal experiment, even though it was embraced by both Clinton and Obama, has completely failed. It's become a farce. And Europeans are figuring this out, too. So that's what Powell did. And then the next year in 72, Richard Nixon, who didn't know at the time that Powell was the author of the memo, at least as far as we know. I mean, he may well have known. In fact, that might be why he put him on the court. But, you know, there's no record of it. But Nixon asked Lewis Powell to get on the Supreme Court in 72. And Powell said yes. It was the second time Nixon had asked him. And Powell said yes. And in 76, Powell had quite a bit of influence on the court. And in 76, for the first time in the history of the United States, in a case called Buckley versus Valeo, the Supreme Court ruled that if rich people give large quantities of money to individual politicians or to political causes, that is not buying influence, which is how it was always perceived to be. I mean, we had the Tillman Act in 1907 that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to a candidate for federal office. We had laws going back to the 19th century on this. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's just fine. It's actually your exercise of your First Amendment free speech rights. And then 2 years later, in a decision that was actually authored by Lewis Powell, a case called First National Bank versus Bilotti, it was the First National Bank of Boston that was funding a campaign that had nothing to do with banking. And there was a law against that in Massachusetts. And Frank Bilotti was the attorney general. And he sued the First National Bank of Boston and said, you can't do this, and tried to fine them. They took it to the Supreme Court. In that case, Lewis Powell said, and that logic that if a person from 76, if a person is contributing to a political campaign, that's free speech, we're going to extend that to corporations as well. And that was in the late fall of 78. By 79, corporations and rich people were starting to get really aggressively involved in politics, and that brought us Ronald Reagan in 1980.
We're speaking with Tom Hartman. So you mentioned the specter of socialism, and among the many tidbits one finds in your books, Tom Hartman, in The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, you quote, well, you don't quote, but you point out that Jefferson, in the context of the Second Amendment discussion, and I'm quoting from your book, Jefferson was also morally offended by the idea of a standing army that people would join because they were so poor that there was no other way to get an education and a job. For such people, he wanted universal free public education, including free college tuition, which he brought into being when he founded the tuition-free University of Virginia. And it's a situation, it seems to me, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We're still having the specter of socialism being brought up in the upcoming electoral campaign as if that's some great evil. But the people, more and more, do want free college education and other aspects of socialism. If you have any comments on that, I'd be happy to hear them. Otherwise, we can move on.
Jefferson was right, and he nailed it, and he put his money where his mouth was. He, in fact, on his tombstone, he wrote his own epitaph for his tombstone. And the first thing it says he did, I believe it says, the author of the Declaration of Independence, founder of the University of Virginia, and something else. He wanted that. I mean, that was one of the big three. He was very, very proud of starting the University of Virginia, and explicitly that it was free education. He was a big believer in that. He felt that without an educated populace, you could not have a functioning republic. And we know the benefits of this. We had this experiment in the 1950s and 60s called the GI Bill, where some 800,000 people, I believe it was, coming back from World War II, got a free education, free college education. And the result of that was that the cost of that education, they paid back 10 times over in additional taxes that they paid that they wouldn't have paid if they didn't make as much money because they didn't have the education. My wife's father was one of those people. He went to college and became a lawyer and became the attorney general for the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. Wouldn't have been able to do it without the GI Bill. My dad went to college for 2 years. He had to drop out. His mom got pregnant with me, but couldn't have done that without the GI Bill. So what we know is that not only does a free college education pay for itself 10 times over, but it also provides substantial benefits to society. The explosion of innovation that happened in the 1960s, in particular in the 1970s, the invention of the transistor, the integrated circuit, leading to the modern digital world, most of that was driven by people who got their degrees as a result of the GI Bill. So free college education. And once we stopped having free college education, it started making college very expensive, which is a relatively recent thing, just in the last 30 years. I mean, my wife and I were both able to put ourselves through college. She graduated, I didn't. But she worked as a waitress at Howard Johnson's, and I worked, I was pumping gas, changing tires at an Exxon station or an Esso station, and I worked as a dishwasher at Bob's Big Boy. You could put yourself through college at a major university with that kind of a job back in the day. And we really need to go back to that. It's just obscene that we haven't.
Do you see a connection? Well, you were speaking of neoliberalism before. Do you see a connection with the current crisis in the affordability of college and the rising inequality in the United States with these decisions that we were just talking about?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Supreme Court enabling money to take over our political process. Once money took over our political process in 1981, they flipped our economic system, but they also flipped our social systems along with it, with this idea of, quote, individual responsibility. And Maggie Thatcher in 1979 saying, there is no such thing as society. It's only a collection of individuals. This bizarre ideology that Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys were promoting has done so much damage to this country. It's the same kind of thinking that Betsy DeVos represents now, trying to actually make college more expensive and less available and destroy public schools, replace them with, you know, for-profit charter schools. It's a scam.
One more thing about Buckley versus Vallejo. That was the personhood argument was under the 14th Amendment. Is that correct?
Well, the 14th Amendment defines equal protection under the law, that all persons are entitled to equal protection under the law. In a decision in 1886, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad that corporations were not entitled to the same protection under the law as natural persons, as human beings. But the clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, wrote a headnote, which is the commentary that goes at the front of a case, which has no legal standing at all, saying that, in fact, the court had ruled that way, even though if you read all the way to the end of the ruling, you find out that the court ruled against the Southern Pacific Railroad. But the court has quoted that headnote some 38 times, I think it is. And the consequence of that has been these corporate rights. I'd have to go back and read the Buckley decision to see if they were citing Santa Clara. I would be surprised if in the First National Bank decision they didn't. And they certainly cited Santa Clara in Citizens United in 2010, in October 2010.
The reason I ask is because there's just so many wonderful tidbits in your books. And one of them applies to the 14th Amendment from 1938 by Justice Hugo Black, who noted that the 14th Amendment at that time had been applied less than 0.5% to the protection of Negroes and more than 50% for corporations.
to use his language, the language of the
Yes, yeah. that was the language of 19. That was the polite language of 1938. Okay, so we find ourselves since the 1980s, a lot of the reasoning by the conservative members of the Supreme Court revolve around what they call originalism. You discuss this in your book. Would you explain what that means and how it's used today?
Yeah, originalism is basically a scam. It popped up a few times in the late 19th century, but it got reinvented and brought forward in the 70s, as I recall, by Robert Bork, who Reagan tried to put on the court, and who was the executioner, essentially, in the Saturday Night Massacre and then during the Nixon administration. And Bork argued that some men had such great insight into history and into the founding of the Republic that they could interpret what the founders really meant when they wrote the Constitution. Now, this is a scam, too, and in fact, a fairly naked one. If you read Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention or any of the ratifying conventions, the notes from the ratifying conventions, or even the Federalist Papers, Madison and Hamilton's efforts to sell the Constitution to the American public in 1788, what you find is that they were all over the map. There was, like we were talking earlier about judicial review, there were some who were in favor of it, some who were opposed to it. They all said yes to the Constitution. So there wasn't any one unanimous perspective on the part of the founders. But this is a little bit like Jerry Falwell saying, you know, I know what God meant, you know, or I know what the Bible means this, you know, you can't be that, or have to do this. Anybody who tells you that they know the mind of God or that they know the mind of the founders, run in the other direction as fast as you can. It's just a scam. They just use it to justify ruling however they want to rule, and often in very contradictory ways.
And this comes up in the book Guns and the Second Amendment, where you actually go back to what the founders were discussing when they did the Second Amendment. And yes, it really has nothing to do with modern conservative arguments. Very briefly,
that's right,
give us your sense of what the actual terms of the discussion were back then. Lay out the context of that time and what they were thinking.
Sure. In the 1780s, we had just fought a horrible war against England, and we were surrounded by hostile forces. There were some very seriously upset Indians to the west. The French held Louisiana territories. The Spanish held Florida. The British held Canada. And there was an army left over from the Revolutionary War. And one of the things that the founders and the framers knew was that other attempts at democracy, and for that matter, any other form of government, had been stymied many, many times over the years by an army, a standing army during time of peace, basically executing a military coup, pulling off a Pinochet or al-Sisi in Egypt. And so they wanted to prevent that from ever happening here in the United States. And this was a broad sentiment, by the way. We had several states, I quote from their constitutions in the book, several states had actually written it into their constitution that there could not be a standing army in those states during times of peace. But as I said, we were surrounded by hostile forces. So what do you do if you're not going to have a standing army because you're worried about military coups? Well, the answer that the founders came up with is you have basically what we today would call the National Guard. Every state has its own state militia. The weapons are typically kept in an armory. Those state militias are called forward during a time of crisis, and they could be called up by the federal government even, as had happened, Shays Rebellion, for example. And that would be the answer. And so they basically wrote that into the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress can basically fund anything they want forever, except the army. The army has to be revisited every 2 years. It is against the Constitution. It's illegal for Congress to appropriate money for the army for more than 2 years. And it was their way of forcing every single Congress, because the House of Representatives is every 2 years, you know, completely turns over, forcing every single Congress to again ask the question, do we want a standing army during time of peace, or will we just rely on the state militias? And it became a little less of an issue over time, but Thomas Jefferson, when he became president, there were several hundred thousand men in the army. And he reduced it down to, as I recall, around 6,000 by the end of his presidency. And he was quite proud of that. You know, in the book, I quote him saying, in one of his letters, saying, you know, he's so proud that in America, we don't have paupers who are willing to be shot at for a sixpence. But the problem was that he did not, as president, while he decimated the army, he did not make sure that the state militias were strengthened, equally strengthened on the other side. And so when we got into the conflict with Britain and Canada in the War of 1812, the British troops were able to march all the way down to Washington, D.C., and famously, as James Madison, the only president to ever command troops in battle, went off to fight the war, Dolly Madison pulled the picture of George Washington out of the White House and rolled it up and stuck it in their dress and took off, and they came in and they burned the White House. So after the War of 1812, that whole conversation about whether we should have a standing army or not just kind of went away. Everybody was in agreement. Okay, that didn't work out well. We're going to have a standing army. But in the meantime, in order to provide for a citizens' militia, a state-by-state militia, there needed to be some sort of enabling legislation. They already had the legislation, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, that said, you know, you're going to have to rethink the army every 2 years. Well, what about the flip side? How do we encourage the states to build their own militias? And that was the Second Amendment. And they were very, very clear about that. There was no discussion about self-defense. There was no discussion about hunting. There was no discussion about sports shooting. There was no discussion about rights to own arms. And the phrase bear arms in the 1700s meant join a military or a militia. It did not mean have a gun in your home. I mean, it was just so clear and so plain. And Scalia used his originalist scam to say that he was reading the minds of the founders and came up with this weird contortionist exercise in the Heller decision. I think if any of the framers were around today, they would just freak out. It would make no sense to them.
We're speaking with Tom Hartman. You do make a connection, however, with race and militias. And even at the time of the founding of the United States, go into that a little bit, please.
In the northern states, the state militias, and this was the time that the Second Amendment was I believe it was ratified in 1791, but it was around that time. It was, you know, a year or three after the entire Constitution. But it was debated during the Constitution because Jefferson had said that if they didn't come up with a Bill of Rights, he would sabotage it in the Virginia Ratifying Convention. So as it was being debated in 1787 and then redebated during the ratifying conventions, the states in the north all had regular militias like today we have as a National Guard. But the states in the south, their militias served triple duty. They were not part-time things where people showed up once a month and drilled. They ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They were referred to as slave patrols. You can't run a police state, which is essentially what the South was. In Georgia, there were actually at one point more people of African ancestry than of European ancestry. Virginia, as Patrick Henry points out, had, as I recall, over 300,000 people enslaved. So you can't run a police state without a police state. You can't have slavery without a police state, essentially. And so these slave patrol militias in Georgia, for example, every white male between 17 and 47 had to show up at least once a week. And every, I forget the period now, I think it's once a month, every slave quarter in the state had to be inspected. And they would ride the roads at night looking for runaway slaves. And they were always ready to put down slave rebellions. And there were a lot of them. And then they also served the third function of being the local police. And I think that's one of the reasons why if you are shot by a stranger in the South, the odds are 1 in 3 that you were shot by a police officer. Policing in the South came out of the slave patrols, and it still shows. And also Patrick Henry at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, the original Second Amendment said for the security of a free nation that, you know, they were going to enable militia, state militias. And Patrick Henry got up, who was the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia, had over 300 slaves. He got up and he gave this impassioned speech, as he was wont to do, about how if we give this power to the federal government, they can, and we ever get a president who is an abolitionist and a Congress that is abolitionist, which, by the way, happened with the election of President Abraham Lincoln, that they will try to end slavery, which is, by the way, what Lincoln did. St. Patrick Henry was pressing, I suppose. But anyhow, he demanded that Madison change the language from "for the security of a free nation" to "for the security of a free state," so that the slave patrols would be covered by it.
I'm glad you brought up Lincoln, because I want to segue into who's on the Supreme Court, how many people are on the Supreme Court, and that has fluctuated over time. As we are recording this interview, hearings are being held in the House of Representatives that may lead to the impeachment of the current president of the United States. Well, when Lincoln went for his second term, he changed his vice president to someone from the opposition party. Lincoln was a Republican, and he chose as his vice president a Democrat, Johnson. Johnson was famously impeached, but not convicted by the Senate. He survived that by one vote. You take it from there about how many members were there in the Supreme Court at that time, and what did the Congress do?
So when Lincoln became president, there were 10 members of the Supreme Court. And when he died, when he was assassinated, Andrew Johnson became president. Johnson was a slave owner. He was a Southerner. He was hated in the North. And the legislature, the House and Senate, the Congress was dominated by Lincoln's Republicans. And they did not want Johnson to be able to appoint another Supreme Court justice. So when this one Supreme Court justice left the court, I believe he died. I'd have to go back and look. And the Supreme Court at that point had 10 people on it. And the Congress got together and said, we do not want this man appointing any more Supreme Court justices. And so they shrank the size of the court down to 7, so that if anybody left the court, then Johnson couldn't replace that person. And then when Ulysses Grant became president after Johnson left, they took it back up to 9, which is where it is now.
And the reason they could do that was because, as you mentioned earlier, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution that empowers the Congress to regulate the Supreme Court.
That's correct. And not just the Supreme Court, all the courts, basically. They also determine the district courts, the circuit courts, all that sort of stuff.
Right. During the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt famously tried to pack the court. Now, the way I always heard that, it was some kind of power move on his part that wasn't democratic or reasonable or any of that kind of stuff. But you present a very different scenario. So tell us what the reasons were and how that went down.
When Franklin Roosevelt became president, the court was quite conservative, and he passed a whole series of reforms that the court kept striking down. They passed laws against child labor. The court struck them down. They passed unemployment. The court struck them down. They tried to pass a minimum wage. The court struck them down. And this went on throughout the first 4 years of his presidency, and it was getting more and more frustrating, not just for Franklin Roosevelt, but for the American public as a whole. People were really seriously angry with the court. And so in 37, after Franklin Roosevelt won re-election in the election of 36, in 37, he comes in and he says, okay, I'm going to do something about this. And this was because the Social Security Act was going to be scrutinized by the Supreme Court in that session, which was fabulously popular across the country, although it was still controversial. You still had a lot of conservatives saying this is the first step down the road to Marxism. But nonetheless, Roosevelt did not want the court striking down Social Security. It was one of his signature acts. And then there was also the National Reconstruction Act. And so he said, we're going to expand the number of justices on the court by saying that all the justices who are over 70 become one vote, essentially. They all become justices emeritus, because the Constitution gives federal judges lifetime appointments. So they'll still be able to sit there and they'll still be able to hear arguments. But altogether, they have one vote. And then we will add additional people. The Republicans, of course, freaked out about this, but there was actually widespread popular support for it. And the thing that caused Franklin Roosevelt ultimately to back off was Justice Owens, as I recall, who was a member of the Four Horsemen, one of the four justices who was constantly striking down these laws, changed his mind and started voting with Roosevelt. And then another justice followed him, and Francis Perkins played a little role in this, and so he just backed off. But, you know, the conservatives have kind of reinvented that history over the years to suggest that Roosevelt was playing dictator and it was a court-packing scheme. Well, it was a court-packing scheme, but it would have failed. In fact, if you go back and read history books that were written in the 1940s and 1950s by people who lived through the era, there was a broad consensus that he had a very, very good chance of succeeding, but he just no longer needed to do it. And once the court started agreeing with him, the public support for court packing just kind of vanished.
So that's court packing. But then there is the modern era where there's kind of taking over the presidency under, let's just say, questionably honorable ways. And you,
very diplomatic.
you revisit the 1968 presidential election between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, and Johnson's efforts before that. Tell our listeners what they need to know about that.
LBJ was terribly unpopular at that point because of the Vietnam War, and so his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, was running for president. And Johnson very much wanted to end the Vietnam War. He was in agony about it. And he knew it was going to stain his memory forever. And so he had actually, in the summer of 68, worked out a deal with both North and South Vietnam where they were going to resolve the war. They were going to end the war, and they were going to do it in September or October of 68, which would have been the original October surprise. It would have easily handed the election to Hubert Humphrey, because Johnson was going to give Humphrey a lot of the credit for it. And Nixon found out about this. It was kind of an open secret. I mean, you can't have a negotiation with two foreign countries, one of whom you're at war with and the other you're an ally with, without leaking. Nixon found out and personally intervened, told the South Vietnamese basically, don't go along with this. Don't go to Paris. Don't sign the agreement, and stay with me, and I'll make you rich, and you individually, as some of the corrupt officials, and then I'll get to end the war and get all the glory. So when Lyndon Johnson heard about this, the CIA was tapping the phones of the people who were handling this on Nixon's behalf. Anna Chenault was the main one out of New Mexico. And when they turned these wiretaps over to Lyndon Johnson, he went nuts. And he called up Everett Dirksen, who, you know, I remember from my childhood. He had this wonderful gravelly voice. And he was the Republican in the Senate who was the grand old man of the Senate and of the Republican Party. Very highly respected. I think even today he would be highly respected. And so anyhow, LBJ calls up Everett Dirksen, and they were close friends. They'd been in the Senate together for years. And says, here's what's going on. He says, I'm reading their hand, Everett, and I don't want to get this into the election because it'll damage people's faith in the integrity of our system. But he said, but what Richard Nixon is doing here is treason. And Everett Dirksen said, yeah, I agree. I know. And LBJ said, can you do something about this? And Dirksen said, well, I'll talk to Nixon. So Dirksen talks to Nixon, and Nixon calls LBJ back a couple of days later and just denies the whole thing. But LBJ knew what was going on. And we didn't hear those tapes until, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. It's just been, you know, 50 years after LBJ's death or whatever the interval was, or after the recordings were made. They were locked up so that nobody who was alive then would still be alive, particularly Richard Nixon. But now we know that Nixon committed treason in order to become president. And then in 1980, the Reagan campaign, and we don't know if Reagan personally knew about this. He was probably not quite as Machiavellian as Nixon, but it certainly seems to have been run by his campaign manager, Bill Casey, who Reagan later made the head of the CIA. And on the day that Casey was to go testify about this in court, he had a seizure in his office in the CIA headquarters and was taken to Bethesda, and they removed the part of his brain, the Broca's region, the left parietal lobe, that controls speech. He basically had his tongue cut out and died once. But Bill Casey was apparently the guy who ran this. President Bonnie Sauter of Iran has written about this. He lives in the United States now. It's not a secret that the Reagan campaign approached the mullahs in 1980 during the campaign against Jimmy Carter and said, if you hold those hostages, we'll start selling you weapons. And in fact, they were shipping weapons. They were shipping spare tires for the fighter jets of the Iranian Air Force via Israel during the election, during the campaign. And so that, you know, the Reagan administration committed treason, and that was the Iran-Contra affair. And that was covered up, interestingly, by a guy by the name of Bill Barr, who was our attorney general in 1992 in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, and recommended, as the Iran-Contra investigation, Lawrence Walsh was closing in on George Bush the senior and some of the other people who were involved in this treason. And Bill Barr said, just pardon all these guys, Ollie North and Elliot Abrams, and there were three others. He said, just pardon them. It'll all be good. It'll go away. And the screaming headline, three column headline, or, you know, all the way across the front page of the newspaper, three lines headline in all caps in the New York Times, Christmas Eve of 1992, was how the cover up had happened. You know, this, and Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor, said he was outraged. He was furious, but it blew over and Barr went back into private life and Bush retired. I mean, this was right after he'd lost the election. So they covered that one up too. And then you got the rather shaky decision in 2000 with Bush v. Gore, where George Bush Sr.'s buddies on the Supreme Court basically gave the election to his son when they stopped the Florida Supreme Court from doing what the Florida Constitution required, which was recounting every vote. And because they didn't do the recount, they didn't learn until a year later when the New York Times did the recount that Al Gore actually won that election in Florida and thus the presidency of the United States.
Yes, and names that are familiar to our listeners. Well, first of all, regarding the Nixon 1968, who knows how many hundreds of thousands of people died before the Vietnam War finally ended in 75?
Yeah, it was probably about 20,000 American soldiers and maybe as many as a million Vietnamese.
However, Nixon was elected. He had four appointments to the Supreme Court, and then Ford, who followed him, had one. Reagan had three, Scalia, Kennedy, and O'Connor. And then George W. Bush, with the help of the Supreme Court, had, two appointments? So there's that. I was interested to learn that John Roberts' name, the current Supreme Court Chief Justice, his name first comes up in the Reagan administration and then again in the rebellion around the 2000 election. He was on the scene there, too. What did he do in the Reagan administration in terms of researching things around the Supreme Court?
Well, when Reagan came into power, the primary thing that was animating the conservative movement in America at that time was two Supreme Court decisions. The 1954 Brown versus Board, which struck down legal segregation and overturned Plessy versus Ferguson, essentially. And the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that struck down state abortion laws. And so John Roberts worked in the Justice Department. And the job that he was given was figure out a way to overturn these two Supreme Court decisions without having to go through all the trouble of passing a constitutional amendment or without altering the Supreme Court, because we're not going to be able to do that in one or two terms, presidential terms. But we would like to make happy our merry band of conservatives who want to see America re-segregated and want women to no longer have power over their reproductive systems. And so Roberts spent quite a bit of time on this, hunkered down in D.C. And he went back to Article 3, Section 2 that we talked about earlier, Joy, where it says that the Supreme Court shall operate under, with exceptions as defined by Congress. And he said, you know, this hasn't been used in the modern era, and it looks like it really hasn't been used historically. But in theory, according to the Constitution, Congress could pass a law that simply says abortion is now illegal and the Supreme Court may not rule on it. Just like that, in that kind of plain language. And under Article 3, Section 2, that would be the law of the land. The Supreme Court would not be able to rule on it, and that would be the end of Roe v. Wade. And the same thing, Congress could pass a law saying there's no law, you know, it's not illegal to have a segregated school, and that would be the end of Brown v. Board. And he wrote this fairly long paper about it that I don't think anybody has ever seen. I mean, I was shocked when I found it. And it's one of the last chapters in my book on the Supreme Court. I think it's titled "In Case of Emergency, Break Glass," which was essentially what Roberts was saying. You know, if we do this, it'll provoke a constitutional crisis. It'll provoke a national outcry. And so it should be a last resort. But here's a way to get around a totally out of control Supreme Court. Increasingly, it's looking like our Supreme Court is or is on the edge of being totally out of control. So it might be a good time to reexamine that.
So they call that court stripping. Now,
jurisdiction stripping.
Yes. Well, it occurred to me when I was reading that could be a way to get around the implications of things like Citizens United.
That's correct.
Well, we're just about out of time, Tom Hartman. You do address remedies towards the end of your book that are pro-democracy remedies to what you present as a despotic, at this point, Supreme Court. Share with our listeners very briefly. We only have 1 or 2 minutes left.
Sure. Well, we've talked about some of them. I mean, changing the number of members of the court, it's also possible to term limit justices. You can't remove them from office. This would be under the regulating power, Article 3, Section 2 of Congress. But you could say that after a certain number of years, members of the court would have to cycle back to being federal court judges in various circuits, or maybe back to whatever circuit they came from. There's the case of emergency break glass part that we just talked about that John Roberts laid out. Of course, taking control of the White House and the Senate again and getting some decent people on the court. I don't recall if there were any other specific remedies in the book. Do you, Joy? Am I missing something?
I think those were the main ones. One controversial thing that keeps coming up is the Article 5 Constitutional Convention. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about this. The Koch brothers and a few other right-wing billionaires have been funding. They're actually running practice sessions every year now in Washington, D.C., where they're sending people from all over the country. Literally every state has sent people to rewrite the Constitution from top to bottom. And Article 5 in the Constitution provides a mechanism to do this, and that's holding a constitutional convention. And these guys are very, very serious about this, and they've gotten over 30 states. It takes 34 states to start the process and 36 or 37 to ratify it. And they've got over 30 states that have signed on. So look out. This is a big story in conservative circles, and it's largely unknown to anybody outside these hardcore legal conservative circles.
Well, we've actually done a couple of programs on it, but it's been a while. Yes. Tom, yeah. Some final words for our listeners. Anything you want.
We're in a very critical time right now. Our country, since the election of Reagan, has been under assault by big business and billionaires. And our form of government, we're seeing country after country right now flip into autocratic rule, former democracies, Turkey with Erdogan, Hungary with Orban, the Philippines with Duterte, Egypt with el-Sisi, now just very recently Brazil with Jair Bolsonaro, Duda in Poland. We're seeing the rise of right-wing movements in countries like France and Great Britain and Germany. This is a very perilous time for even the idea of a pluralistic society and a democratic republic. So people need to get informed, and they need to get active, and tag your it. Get out there and get active.
Well, Tom Hartman, thank you again for joining us today on Forthright Radio. We so appreciate your work and for spending this time with us.
Thanks, Joy. I really appreciate it. And thanks for such a great interview. I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate that. Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Tom Hartman. We have been discussing his latest books, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, and The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, both from Barrett Kohler Publishers. It was recorded on September 26, 2019. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media. And we'll go out with the stirring words of Greta Thunberg addressing the United Nations Climate Action Summit on September 23rd, 2019. Till next time, this is Joy LaClaire signing out for now.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering, people are dying, entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. How dare you continue to look away and come here saying that you're doing enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight? You say you hear us and that you understand the urgency. But no matter how sad and angry I am, I do not want to believe that. Because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil, and that I refuse to believe. The popular idea of cutting our emissions in half in 10 years only gives us a 50% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees and the risk of setting off irreversible chain reactions beyond human control. 50% may be acceptable to you, but those numbers do not include tipping points, most feedback loops, additional warming hidden by toxic air pollution, or the aspects of equity and climate justice. They also rely on my generation sucking hundreds of billions of tons of your CO2 out of the air with technologies that barely exist. So a 50% risk is simply not acceptable to us, we who have to live with the consequences. To have a 67% chance of staying below a 1.5 degrees of global temperature rise, the best odds given by the IPCC, the world had 420 gigatons of CO2 left to emit back on January 1st, 2018. Today, that figure is already down to less than 350 gigatons. How dare you pretend that this can be solved with just business as usual and some technical solutions? With today's emissions levels, that remaining CO2 budget will be entirely gone within less than 8.5 years. There will not be any solutions or plans presented in line with these figures here today, because these numbers are too uncomfortable, and you are still not mature enough to tell it like it is. You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line. The world is waking up. And change is coming, whether you like it or not. Thank you.